You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights, down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, listeners. Annie here. G'day, Anila. How are you?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Getting very chilly.
Oh, I know. We had wind and rain at the same time. Melbourne's excelling.
It feels like
itself.
Melbourne again.
Yes, that's right. It's excelling itself. Anyway, we've got lots of things to talk about today besides the weather. I wanted to kick off with a fantastic piece of journalism that I came across by Harkit Singh. We're all aware that the Bowsers are petrol Bowsers are coming to an end, and everybody should be buying electric cars quite clearly. Apparently, the Straits of Hormuz is open. This is the thing that's supposed to be causing the stop in the flow of oil and petrol. Because of the Iranian, you know, the American-Israeli war on Iran. But this is what they report. This is what Harkit Singh reports. It has been open every day since February the 28th. The IRGC never closed it. What the IRGC did is convert 21 miles of international waterway into a permissioned gate with a toll booth, a vetting process and a guest list. Traffic has collapsed 70% to 80%, but the handful of tankers that transit each day do so with IRGC clearance, paid in yuan or USDT at $2 million to $4 million per vessel. The process is now documented. A tanker operator contacts an IRGC-linked intermediary. The operator submits vessel ownership, flag state, cargo manifest, destination crew list and AIS transponder data. The IRGC runs background checks, no US linked ownership, no Israeli cargo, no flagging to aggressor states. If approved, a toll is negotiated. Payment is executed in cash, Chinese yuan or USDT on the Tron network. The IRGC issues VHF radio clearance with specific time window and route through Iranian territorial waters near Larak Island, where IRGC Navy performs visual confirmation. The vessel transits. No physical escort is provided. The protection, in inverted commas, is the removal of the interdiction threat. You are safe because the entity that would attack you has decided not to. China passes, India passes, Pakistan, Turkey, Malaysia, Iraq, Bangladesh pass. Shadow fleet operators aligned with Russia pass. Not all pay the full toll. Some receive exemptions through government-to-government arrangements. Some pay reduced rates, some pay nothing because the geopolitical alignment is payment enough. The system is not a blockade. It is a membership club with a cover-charged denomination in currencies that are not the US dollar. Now, it's fascinating because this article goes on to how the capitalist system regulates this new system. The insurance industry has done something no government intended. It has formalised IRGC authority over the strait in actuarially mathematics. A tanker that pays the toll is insurable. A tanker that does not is stranded. Dozens of vessels sit outside the strait right now, unable to transit because no underwriter will cover them. Lloyd's of London and the international insurance market have withdrawn standard hull and machinery coverage for Hormuz transits. War risk policies now carry premiums of up to 5% of vessel value. That's $5 million for a $100 million tanker per voyage. But the actuary models that price those premiums now incorporate IRGC vetting status as a risk reduction variable. If a vessel can prove it has paid the toll and received VHS clearance, the probability of loss drops from above 20% to below 5%. The same models that price hurricane risks and earthquake exposure are now pricing IRGC compliance as a safety factor. Every toll... Anyway, there you go. Capitalism realigns itself.
Yeah. And there's been a bit of an attempt to, I guess, break down that niche club of members that have access to the Strait of Hormuz at the moment. Bahrain this week introduced a resolution to the UN Security Council that would authorise the use of force in the Strait of Hormuz to, quote, keep the strait open with all necessary means. And this would be essentially military action that would be used to repress, neutralise and deter attempts to obstruct international navigation. But the proposal is facing significant resistance, according to three council diplomats who spoke to the Associated Press. The draft placed under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which authorises measures up to the use of force. And it's worth bearing in mind the way that the UN works. The only resolutions that are actually required to be implemented are those passed at the UN Security Council.
Yeah.
All of the rest of them are just suggestions, but if it's passed at the UN Security Council, states have to take
action.
And
it can be vetoed by any one of the five.
One of the five veto states. So good segue, actually, Annie, because so China and Russia, they're both veto-wielding states. They are, as you would imagine, in direct opposition to the text of the draft. France separately has introduced a competing resolution on Monday that makes no mention of Iran. This would authorise, rather than authorising use of force, it would instead urge all parties to de-escalate and return to diplomacy. This is a good segue, I think, to talking about what's going on more broadly in the Israel-US conflict. It doesn't look like negotiation is on the table, that's for sure. It looks, it looks to be escalating.
The orange lunatic keeps talking about, yes, we're talking, but the Iranians keep saying, basically, you can't make a deal with the devil, so no, we're not talking.
No,
they've learned their lesson. They've learned their lesson.
So Trump has it. Actually, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's set the scene first about what kind of horrors have been happening in the region this week and what's to come. So we've had continuing airstrikes, obviously, and some of these have included strikes on Tehran, Isfahan and Mashhad, according to the Associated Press. At least 1,937 people have been killed so far.
Oh, my God.
According to Iran's deputy health minister. He also said that 240 of the dead were women, 212 were children, and at least 24,800 people have been injured. Life-changing injuries,
yes,
worth mentioning. There's also been some whispers about what might be coming next strategically for the US in terms of on-the-ground invasion. So Axios reporter Barak Ravid, who is a former IDF intelligence officer, has reported that the Pentagon is developing options for a potential major escalation against Iran that could involve ground troops and an intensified bombing campaign. US officials and other sources suggested that in an attempt to make, quote, a final blow and declare a decisive victory, the Pentagon is considering four options. Firstly, invading or blockading Karg Island, which is Iran's main oil export hub. Secondly, potentially invading Larak, which is an island that helps Iran solidify its control over the Strait of Hormuz. The strategic outposts host Iranian bunkers, attack craft that can blow up cargo ships and radars that monitor movements in the strait. The third option is seizing the strategic island of Abu Musa and two smaller islands which lie near the western entrance to the strait and are controlled by Iran but also claimed by the UAE. And then the final kind of option on the table is blocking or seizing ships that are exporting Iranian oil on the eastern side of the Hormuz Strait. The report from Axios News went on to report that President Trump hasn't made a decision yet, but that a major escalation was likely if negotiations made no progress. And it's, you know, it seems clear that these negotiations are not actually in the process of being undertaken. So there's no real signs of diplomacy underway, despite Trump's insistence that there are. Iranian officials have rejected a 15-point proposal that the US passed through mediators. And Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi stated that, quote, no negotiations have happened with the enemy until now, and we do not plan on any negotiations. Araghchi added that the US tried to send messages to Iran through other nations, but that is not a conversation nor a negotiation.
Fascinating stuff. Obviously, the other things that have been reported is that there's been strikes and damage and obviously probably injury in Jaffa, or which is now called Tel Aviv, and there's a suppression not only in America but in Israel in over reporting what's actually happening. So actually, in Trump actually has tried to say that he will try reporters with treason if they don't do the White House line regarding the war, which is a very scary approach towards authoritarianism if we're not already there for the Americans. But another,
he's making it hard enough to report on anyway by changing his mind every two seconds.
Yeah, but the other thing is little tidbits on the overall approach of blanket news is that in America, apparently, they've now increased the age of people that can be accepted into the army to 40. And also they've swept aside any dope convictions. In the past, you weren't allowed to apply to become an army person if you had any, even one conviction of smoking marijuana, which is fascinating considering, yeah, well, considering a whole lot of things, but but the point is that now they've increased the age of people that are acceptable from 35 to 40, which is a bad sign. And I'll tell you something else that was an interesting caveat to that. In England, they've increased the age for people who can be reservists to 65. That's a real dad tummy.
Honestly, I don't think this is controversial. I'm not looking forward to, as a young person, the next 60 years of dealing with the fallout of these constant endless wars and climate change. It's looking very bleak. And I am, you know, for context for listeners, I live with a couple of 70-year-olds, so proper boomers. And I was saying to them, like, do you think in your lifetime does this feel like more unrest than you've experienced previously? And they said, yes, this definitely feels chaotic in a way that things have not felt before. And they mentioned part of that might be because of the constant stream of information that we have now because of things like social media and the internet. But it just seems, according to the boomers that are my source, that it is particularly kind of chaotic internationally. And there seems to be, a level of international dysfunction that they don't remember in living memory.
Well, a French politician that gave a speech in their parliament, whatever they call it, deriding the American House as it is, the White House as it is, comparing it to Nero's Rome. And he went through each of the key players in major sections of the government, you know, the heads of justice, and all of them are completely unsuitable for their roles.
Depending on what you're trying to get out of the role.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's that.
They're doing a great job of lining the right pockets.
But that's called chaos in itself. Mm. The tying of personal greed to monumental public outcomes is really, really horrendous. And I suppose it's the pinnacle of the crazy individualistic notions that are supposed to have been driving American. But America's a big place. I mean, it depends where you stand. I mean, you know, the experience of white people, rich white people. I mean, to be racist about it, rich white people is quite a completely different experience from people who are living, you know, hand to mouth, or returned service people who are now homeless.
And I think it's a point that kind of goes without saying, obviously, but it's like a clear illustration of the risks of having really concentrated power, obviously within a country, having a group of elites that have this outsized influence over the goings-on of a country, but beyond that, at an international level, having one country that's got this massive ability to shape the future of the human race as a whole.
Yeah.
And most of the population of the world has no say in who's running that country.
I know, this is the key, isn't it? And this is what the battle lines really are. I mean, one of the things that by having a media that concentrates on, well, that's what media does. So journalism is about recording event, right? That's what it's about. And over time, it's become far more gossipy and opinionated, which is not quite the same as reporting. And interestingly enough, in journalism, in the past, they used to employ reporters separate from the writers, the journalists. So there would be these go-getter guys who'd go out into the street and collect data. And then it would be written up in florid language and politicised, or gone through the political sieve, one assumes, of the paper, and then released. But the bare bones of data is a completely different kettle of fish. But even that, an event, once the event's happened, it's over, it's done. But it runs through a list of things that are considered to be important. Who said it? Is it an important person? You know, that's why on 3CR there was this political change. It's not just an important person who's been asked to tell you what their frame of reference is. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's going on at the moment is that with this war in Iran, this war by the US and Israelis, what's going on is that, for example, in the West Bank, there's stories of horrendous masks, hundreds of masked Israeli colonists attacking Palestinians in their homes and unseating them from their homes, like dispossessing them from the homes. Like this mawkish, Halloweenish sort of, they've got masks and of course they're backed up by their the IDF. So that's going on at the same time. They're furthering their land grab because they've got an idea about how big Israel really should be, of course.
Mm.
And that intrudes into Egypt. It intrudes into Libya, Egypt and Lebanon and a whole range of, and Jordan. There's a whole range of the people's countries that they believe that they should own. So there'll be there into the endless war. And so this other war is a cover for them increasing their footprint. And at the same time, people are talking about how Trump and many other rich people's misdemeanors in regards to pedophilia are also being sidestepped. And at the moment, what's going on in South America is that the Americans are increasing their warfare on various countries nearby under the guise of attacking warlords, drug cartels. But of course, what's going on in Cuba is just a suppression of an entire country.
Mm. And we've had, I think, two more vessels bombed by the US this week. I think that was on the coast of Cuba. And I didn't end up recording or making a note of this headline, actually, but I think there's been a massive increase in internal kind of collapse in Cuba as a result of the increased pressures in particular, it seems like the medical system is really struggling right now, and there's been lots of deaths as a result of there being no energy in hospitals. So I think there was a, I couldn't tell you the stats, but there was an ICU, an entire ICU that ended up passing away because they didn't have access to electricity.
Well, you know, you wonder why Australia thinks it's important to be backing these outrageous behaviours. And as citizens of this country, we probably need to stand up. This is a really nice song from Bruce Hearn that depicts the horror of capitalism, really, for the ordinary person.
To tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, bricks and mortar and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodle-dee-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? You called me Al. It was Al all the time. Don't you remember? I was your pal. Brother, can you spare a dime? Don't you remember, you called me Al, it was Al all the time. Don't you remember, I was your pal, brother, can't you spare a dime?
Yeah, that was Bruce Hearn doing a version of a very old song. We're going to go to Sydney now with a recording from Vivian Langford at the 14th of the 3rd Anti-Raw
war, Stop the War rally. It was, and this is Abigail Boyd. She's an MP, a Green MP, and she goes through...
A Green MP.
A Green MP. An MP for the Greens. That's like that old film, The Boy with Green Hair. It's really funny. Okay, and she lays out why Australia really should pull its socks up and why we should out AUKUS.
Our first speaker is Miss Abigail Boyd, MLC, from the Greens New South Wales. Abigail campaigns for action on climate change, a progressive economy that serves the whole society, and a government that looks after our most vulnerable people. She's a lawyer, and among her portfolios in the Greens representation in the New South Wales Parliament are industrial relations and gendered violence and abuse. Please welcome Abigail Boyd.
It is great to see you all here. We are gathered here today on unceded Aboriginal land to say no more to imperialist wars of aggression. Australia, along with other nations of the global north, like the United Kingdom and Canada, are being weaponized in the service of an increasingly belligerent US foreign policy, of which the illegal war being waged on Iran by Israel and the United States is just the latest flashpoint.
Shame.
Under the war parties, Australia has engineered itself deeper and more inextricably into the American war machine. We are increasingly compromised and complicit in the war crimes and immorality of the actions being waged against innocent civilian populations around the world. Shame. Australia was first out of the gate to endorse Trump and Netanyahu's illegal assault on Iran.
Shame.
Shame. In the 2 weeks since, as the atrocities mount, they have only doubled down on their support. Australian weapons, material and personnel are directly involved in the war on Iran. The Albanese government has given up any pretense of supporting international law. The public statements of Albanese and Wong are clear they are indifferent to the legality of America's actions. They support the war because it is a war being waged by America. This encapsulates exactly the trajectory that the AUKUS War Pact places us on. Under the AUKUS War Pact, Australia is being pulled into a doom loop that we have to pull out of before we are sucked under. This is not an alliance of equals. It is a relationship of sycophancy and a geopolitical PR exercise that provides a veneer of credibility to US illegal acts of aggression. This is an agenda being driven by an American imperialist ideology, aided and abetted by ghouls and parasites who seek to profit off human suffering and misery.
Shame.
AUKUS tethers Australia entirely to the American war machine, utterly stripping us of sovereignty and the right to chart our own way in the world. The propaganda machine is in full swing, seeking to manufacture consent for the war in Iran. You need look no further to see its perverse operations than in the breathless coverage of the Iranian women's soccer players who sought asylum. The Australian media and political class have been quick to hold this up as an example of Australia acting as a benevolent force, working to protect Iranian people from the war and oppressive regime back home. But at the same time, at the exact same time, on the very same day, Australia showed its true policy towards the people of Iran by announcing their intention to block nearly 7,000 Iranian citizens already granted visitor visas from being able to enter Australia.
Shame!
When an appalling act of cruelty and disgusting display of hypocrisy for an illegal war raining bombs on the civilian population of Iran, to then seek credit for granting protection to a handful of high-profile individuals while slamming the door in the face of thousands more seeking the same protection, it's disgraceful.
Shame.
This is more evidence that this war is not about liberation. US and Israeli bombs, supported by the AUKUS alliance of Australia and UK military assistance, hardware and personnel, will not assist any Iranian people's struggle for freedom. They were never designed to. The region is on fire and the Iranian people are being used as pawns in the geopolitical games of a flailing US empire. This is not defense. This is an attempt to control a region its resources and its governments by an imperial power that has never been held accountable for the destruction it has left behind. Once again, Australia is acting as the loyal deputy, lending legitimacy to a war built on the same logics that brought us Iraq, that brought us Afghanistan, that brought us Libya. How many times? How many more? When will we learn the lessons? It seems that the only lessons Australia has learnt are rhetorical ones. The Albanese government say they are not the Howard government. That's true, in the sense they haven't even attempted to make a genuine public argument in favour of Australian involvement. They have simply proceeded. They've proceeded under an Orwellian turn of phrase that says this war is not a war, but merely defence. That Australia is providing intelligence, hardware and personnel to a conflict on the other side of the world in an act of self-defense. We're told there's no alternative. And so, as this government prepares to spend hundreds of billions in nuclear submarines to entrench our position in that war machine, while it binds our defense planning permanently to Washington's strategic agenda, people in this country cannot afford rent. Centrelink is failing people, hospitals are at breaking point, climate disasters are coming faster and harder, and the government tells us there is no money to respond. There is money. There is always money for war. There is just never money for people. And as war continues, with it is more economic turmoil and the threat of increasing austerity to further punish the many at the expense of the wealthy, war-hungry few. This war, as all wars, is a blight on our collective human spirit. But these are decisions made by Australia that are not inevitable. They're decisions made by governments that can be pressured, challenged, and changed. And that pressure starts here. In moments like this one, in people who are willing to stand up and say clearly, not in our name. We know the history, we see what is happening, and we refuse to look away. The people of Iran deserve peace. The people of Australia deserve a government that chooses diplomacy over destruction. And the future of the globe and that of billions of working class people who inhabit it should never be decided by the foreign policy of a declining empire lashing out in a desperate bid to maintain its hegemony. Thank you so much. Stand with you. The Greens stand with you. We will always, always stand for peace.
That was fantastic, Abigail. Thank you so much.
Melbourne, we are stronger together. Join with unionists, people of faith, young people and refugees to affirm the strength of our diverse communities. We all need to feel a sense of belonging and be assured of justice and fair treatment. Come along to Stronger Together, Palm Sunday, 29th of March. Gather on Prince's Bridge at 1 p.m. with banners and placards, then walk to Birrarung Mar Lower Terrace. There'll be speakers and music from 2 p.m. We walk to embrace and celebrate our differences, say no to all cruelty and injustice, and stand up for freedom and peace. See you on the bridge. Stronger Together, Palm Sunday the 29th of March from 1 p.m. Search for Stronger Together on Facebook for more information. Refugee Advocacy Network is a 3CR supporter.
Yeah, that's right, Palm Sunday, and that's tomorrow. And interestingly enough, Anella, I noticed on my way here in the early hours that there's also a fun run for the kids. So all the trams are all kaput in Latrobe Street, Flinders Street and all around the place because of the fun run, but not because of protests. Mm-hmm. It's okay for fun runs, not for protests. I thought that was pretty funny.
But I reckon also we were talking in the break about it's dark times. It's dark times at the moment. And I think Easter, not to get too religious on our audience, but I think the whole point of Easter as a period of time is reflecting on loss, reflecting on endings, grief. And I think maybe we would all benefit from showing up on Palm Sunday and having a bit of a public grieve.
Oh, well, I think you're probably right. But I do think that capitalism just went a step too far when they made the hot cross buns that were supposed to commemorate the death day
I totally
and put
agree.
Chocolate in it. I thought that was far. Probably just a step too far. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Anila, and we're going to move to a piece from The Attack on AI Accountability. This is from a Trade Justice Hour webinar. They're centred in America, but of course a whole lot of these kind of issues are actually directly affecting the globe, the global community. Whatever the American big tech people want to do is we're all in their line of sights. So this is Richard Bailey from the Public Citizen Digital Alliance outlining how the Orange Fool has been backed by big tech because they expect to get what they want.
Broadly, the story is that the federal government, on behalf of its big tech donors, has been pushing really hard to kill domestic attempts at regulating the digital ecosystem broadly, not just AI, both through federal deregulation and by dropping enforcement actions against big tech companies. I plan to briefly, in my presentation, cover the other side of this, how big tech is using its proximity to Trump, the Trump administration, to push for global deregulation of the tech space and what this means for the development of AI. Now, I think you're all aware of the proximity between big tech and this administration. I mean, the examples of this are so numerous that it's impossible to actually list all of them. I mean, they range from the sort of massive donations made to Trump's campaign, his inauguration fund, his ballroom redevelopment project. Of course, they love hobnobbing over dinner and drinks and so forth. And in return for all of this, the Trump administration is basically using the trade tools at its disposal to push for global tech deregulation. So the administration's intent to go to bat for big tech was made very clear in the first few months of Trump's taking office early last year. So in January last year, the president unveiled his America First trade policy, following which he implemented his reciprocal tariffs in April. Now, it's important to focus on two things that fed into the decision-making process behind these tariffs. The first was a special report by the US Trade Representative, which interestingly has not been disclosed to the public. We've actually filed a FOIA request for this report, but it's gone unanswered. So we've actually filed a lawsuit against the administration, which is still pending. Nonetheless, we suspect that this report was largely informed by industry comments. The second input is the National Trade Estimates Report. Now, this, the NTE report, is an annual report released by the US Trade Representative that basically claims to list non-tariff trade barriers that US companies face. So it's by and large been a laundry list of complaints that US industry raises with other countries' laws and practices. Most of the report is actually quite ridiculous. So for instance, it complains that other countries don't automatically accept US safety standards for drug approvals, or it'll say things like, you know, Muslim majority countries require meat or poultry to adhere to halal standards and so on. But this report has become really important now because it's what basically President Trump waved around while announcing his reciprocal tariffs back in April. So he basically linked the imposition of these punitive tariffs to the supposed non-tariff barriers identified by the USTR in the NTE report. And of course, his rhetoric has continued since then, particularly on social media, Truth Social, where he's frequently threatened countries for regulating the digital ecosystem. So what are all these non-tariff barriers that big tech and their lobby groups are complaining about? Now, we mapped out the comments submitted by groups that are known lobbying fronts for big tech to the USTR's reciprocal tariffs report. The comments of these industry lobby groups attack a host of digital regulations around the world, over 100 laws and policies in over 45 different jurisdictions. You can actually go to our website and sort of play around with this map, with this data. Now, the targets of attack include anti-monopoly laws, or laws that seek to prevent consumers or smaller businesses from the dominance of big tech companies, data protection and privacy laws, for instance, that try and ensure companies can't misuse our personal data, revenue sharing regulations, so for example, laws that require big tech companies to compensate news producers for using their content, various forms of taxation applied to big tech companies, online safety regulations, and many, many more. Of particular interest to this conversation, though, are six jurisdictions whose AI laws are mentioned: Canada, the European Union, Brazil, Australia, Korea, and the UAE, all of which are relatively early adopters of AI regulation. We also mapped the comments of industry lobby groups to the USTR's next NTE report, which will be released at the end of this month. This exercise actually then shows us that the demands of tech companies have only increased in the 1 year that Trump has been in power. We now, in fact, see that digital regulations in over 60 jurisdictions are targeted, with the number of regulations and policies under attack also rising into the multiple hundreds. So we counted over 350, but then gave up because it was just too many. AI regulations being targeted have also more than doubled to 13 jurisdictions now. So you have Ecuador, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, Kenya, Malaysia, Vietnam, Japan, Taiwan, added to those that I already mentioned. What these two exercises basically show us is what the shopping list of big tech is. What are the deregulatory demands being made for the Trump administration to then go around and bully countries into? And unfortunately, this appears to be working to some degree. A number of countries have relaxed or given up on some of their digital regulations even before trade negotiations can actually happen. So, for example, India withdrew a tax it applied on foreign digital advertising services, while Australia stopped implementing its news bargaining code, which is a law that required social media platforms to share some of their revenue with the news industry, who they've been cannibalizing. Other countries have been forced to give up on various other methods of regulating big tech in order to bring Trump to the negotiating table. So, for instance, Canada was forced to withdraw its plans to tax big tech companies just to get Trump to the negotiating table. More worrying are the series of extremely one-sided trade deals that many Latin American and Asian countries have signed up to over the past few months. All these agreements, however, contain sweeping commitments that significantly limit how the signatories, which are mostly smaller countries that can't stand up to US bullying, how they can regulate the digital ecosystem and emerging technologies such as AI. So let me illustrate by going through some of the issues that big tech has demanded and that the Trump administration is forcing other countries to agree to. Now, the first provision concerns source code and algorithmic disclosure. So for those who aren't familiar, source code basically refers to the machine-readable series of instructions that a computer program uses to perform a particular task. Now, of course, the growth of the AI ecosystem and the integral nature of software to our lives means it's really important to be sure that a computer program actually does what it says, especially when it's being used for really important things like, you know, hiring and firing, determining credit or social benefit eligibility, or even, say, predictive policing. Software can be programmed to serve illicit purposes or can have baked-in biases or other unintended consequences. So one of the ways in which you can try and prevent this is to actually scrutinize the source code of a program or an AI system. However, what big tech is doing is pushing for these trade agreements to include clauses that prohibit governments, regulators, and independent researchers and third parties from accessing source code except under very, very narrow circumstances. Essentially, this is akin to a drug being released in the market without a regulator being able to assess the safety and efficacy of the product. Also, given that most countries are still trying to figure out how exactly to regulate AI system, it makes very little sense to actually give up the ability to look under the hood of these systems at this very early stage. Indeed, a number of proposed and extant AI-related laws, whether it's in the US or in countries like the EU and others, can be challenged using these provisions. The second issue concerns cross-border data flows. Now, we all know that data is an extremely valuable resource today, particularly given its use for AI training. And so who controls this data and how it's used is an important public policy question for all governments. There are many legitimate reasons a government might need to regulate such flows of data. So, for example, they may need to ensure that domestic data protection, privacy, or cybersecurity law can be applied to the data. Practically speaking, data is subject to the laws of the jurisdiction where it's physically located. And enforcement of these laws may be difficult if the data is moved offshore. There may also be a need to ensure that data is made accessible to domestic regulators to perform supervisory or administrative functions, or that it can be used to promote domestic economic growth, part of the whole digital sovereignty narrative, which is becoming increasingly prevalent around the world. So big tech is therefore pushing for these provisions that will force countries to allow their data to be exported to the US, which has very poor privacy regulations, or indeed other jurisdictions which have even lesser protections without any limitations or restrictions. So in short, this means that companies will be free to take your data abroad where it could be traded, used to train AI, or otherwise misused irrespective of what your domestic law actually says. A third important issue is that of non-discrimination. Now, non-discrimination itself is a foundational principle of international trade law. Simply put it, it means that a country has to treat similar products or services arriving from different countries similarly. However, this concept is increasingly being abused by big tech companies to challenge any regulation that adversely affects them. Basically, what big tech companies are doing is claiming that any law, even if it's applicable to all the players in a given ecosystem, can be considered discriminatory just because it has a greater effect on them. Which, of course, most laws will, because these companies tend to be the biggest players in any market. Now, we're all aware that many sectors of the digital economy are highly concentrated for a variety of reasons, you know, ranging from first mover advantages to economies of scale, network effects, and so on. This allows big tech companies to get away with a host of behaviors that harm both users and smaller companies. So we're all aware, you know, of the kind of one-sided terms and conditions that we're all forced to sign up to when we try and use any of these services. So to combat such practices, a number of jurisdictions are trying to implement pro-competition regulations or asymmetric obligations to target large or dominant players. So for example, the European Union has implemented what they call the Digital Markets Act to create a more level playing field. You also have more targeted initiatives such as that in Korea, which implemented a law to regulate app stores because, you know, they have discriminatory and anti-competitive behavior. Now, a number of countries have also put in place online safety laws that, you know, put in place graded obligations on platforms based on their size or their reach or their user base. Similarly, in the AI ecosystem, a number of laws place higher regulatory demands on bigger platforms or systems, basically those that pose a greater risk. All of these kinds of measures are susceptible to challenge using these so-called anti-discrimination provisions. As to how these provisions can be misused, we've already seen the US Trade Representative launch an investigation into, for example, Brazil's digital policies, including their data protection law, as well as social media regulations, including laws regarding deepfakes in the electoral context. So based on this investigation, the US can then impose tariffs on Brazilian imports. We're now likely to see the initiation of a host of other Section 301 investigations as Trump needs to find alternate authorities to impose his tariffs after the Supreme Court decision last month. We've already seen two such investigations being started into forced labor practices and excess capacity in certain sectors. But I think it's only a matter of time before digital regulations are also caught in the crossfire. Separately, the Republican majority in Congress has also held a number of hearings on behalf of big tech, naming and shaming various jurisdictions. For example, the European Union, Korea, Brazil, and so on, for implementing digital regulations. Specifically in the AI context, many of you may be aware that of the recent sort of global controversy around AI notification apps. A number of countries ranging from India, Indonesia, Malaysia, the UK, European Union, and so on, have banned or are otherwise trying to regulate access to such systems. All of these attempts could then be challenged under trade agreement provisions that relate to non-discrimination or even provisions related to the need to protect foreign investments. In addition, it's also important to keep in mind that while the US is pushing for deregulation, including in the AI space, it's also pushing really hard for other countries to enhance market access for its big tech and AI companies. So basically, this means that not only are countries going to be forced to use US-based AI systems, they'll be unable to effectively prevent harms that arise from these very systems. Big tech is super clever. They know way more about the direction technology is taking than most governments, and this allows them to preempt any regulatory attempts before governments are fully aware of just how much power they are handing over. So for instance, when Trump renegotiated NAFTA during his first administration into the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement, the big tech lobby successfully snuck in this digital trade chapter that included really bad provisions on source code, data flow, and non-discrimination before anyone really understood what the implications would be. But now, in the upcoming USMCA review, the process which has already started, big tech companies are actually pushing for even more provisions that would further limit the ability of the signatory countries, the US, Mexico, and Canada, to regulate emerging technologies such as AI as well as quantum computing. So specifically, big tech has enlarged its demands to ensure that regulators and governments are barred from accessing what they call model weights. That is basically the value assigned to different input parameters that an algorithm considers when it's making a decision. They also want to allow AI systems to be trained for free on copyrighted content, basically allow them to steal everyone's work. And also they want to prevent the development of local standards and certification mechanisms. So basically, we're seeing an undercutting of yet-to-be-developed AI regulations and without any proper democratic debate or discussion. So the citizens of all these countries get no say whatsoever on any of these issues. So to conclude, big tech has found a willing ally in the White House to do their bidding on a domestic and a global basis. They fund Trump in exchange for him bullying countries to sign up to trade agreements that significantly affect their ability to regulate the digital ecosystem, while also pushing for countries to buy more US-made AI products. This obviously could have significant impacts, not just on civil rights in the online space, but it also affects the wide variety of social and economic relationships that AI and other technologies have increasingly come to intermediate. Think, for instance, of the rise of algorithmic management and how the lack of transparency in such systems can change relations between labor and management. Another important aspect to consider is the establishment of a new colonialist extractivist paradigm in the AI space, which will basically see global South countries export raw materials in the form of data, which are then converted to AI products by US-based tech companies and then sold back to developing countries at a premium. But we are beginning to see some pushback. So, for example, Malaysia has said that it considers its reciprocal trade deal with the US to be null and void following the Supreme Court's tariff repeal. And in many other countries, citizens have launched constitutional appeals to these deals, which have been negotiated under extreme secrecy and, of course, in great haste. Even domestically, we've had, for instance, more than 100 members of Congress writing to the USTR about the USMCA review and demanding that bad digital trade provisions should be removed from this. Also because now big tech is pointing to the USMCA as a fait accompli and saying that these digital trade provisions must now be ceded in every other trade agreement. Digital trade rules are unfortunately enforceable. Unlike most aspects of international law, which we now know is basically, let's say, it's whatever the powerful decide, international trade law is actually enforceable. So when countries say that they will not regulate a particular type of technology, they can then be sued and have to face damages of one kind or another, which is why it becomes important to prevent these kind of provisions being put into trade agreements, because then they can be used to stop regulation that affects you, me, and people abroad. It's not just people in countries outside the US, but domestically as well.
G'day, my name is Margie Thorpe. You are listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 on your dial.
A weak solidarity, Brekkie Team listener, when hostilities in Iran and Zion incursions across the Middle East are about to end. Not just because US of the UN of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor boasted, we've won, the biggest we've won ever, 3 weeks ago. But more importantly, that revered world statesperson, true blue Aussie big supremo Anthony Albanese, urged the US of and Zion to cease hostilities. That should do the trick. We've become aware over time that every time Anthony or the minister were going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, penny left wing, call on the parties to, etc., the incredible impact it has on the parties called on. Donald and his marionette master, Zion Supremo Benjamin, not another Yahoo, reacting favourably as usual. A true blue Aussie has spoken. And don't forget, Anthony on our behalf supported the slaughter and destruction, so he must know Donald was spot on. And he has more important things, this is Anthony, of course, to worry about, like an energy crisis, thanks to the slaughter and destruction he supports. But now says the job is done, which we'd understand a lot better if we had the slightest idea what the job is. Although Zion settlers in the West Bank, backed up by Benjamin's trained killers, have ignored Anthony's plea, continuing to invade and burn and destroy and displace non-land, non-people Palestinian villages and farms, who only have themselves to blame, for non-land, non-people, by definition, have no right to land, no right to be terrorists, which Benjamin and the settlers assure us they are, and every right to be terrorized by the occupiers who are not terrorists. See, it's obvious that if you oppose or resent being terrorized, then you are a terrorist. The being offensive and trained killing war is running parallel to a war of words. Donald assuring us Iran wants to do a deal. Evil Iran insisting it doesn't. Yes, you do. No, we don't. Because everything with the Don is doing a deal. former FBI Supremo Robert Mueller, a typical US old political figure with whom I suspect we'd have very little in common, terrorised poor Donald by investigating a Russian link to Donald's 2016 election, Russian deal, and found, yes, there was a link, but no, he couldn't find enough evidence to charge Donald with anything, but that was enough for Donald to realise what a dangerous maniac Mueller was, a horrible, horrible person. And yet, with his renowned magnanimity and generosity and live and let live, Donald paid his tribute to Mueller. Good. I'm glad he's dead. He can no longer hurt innocent people. Poor, hurt, innocent Donald. Wonder what those poor, hurt, innocent people rotting in cells, after being picked up by Donald's ICE thugs, think about that. In a major decision, Donald's Secretary for War, for being offensive and trained killing Pete Hug Killstuff, has banned photographers from Pentagon press conferences because he didn't like a particular picture of himself. If only Pete would restrict himself to vital decisions on such critical global matters, the world would be a lot better place. His commander-in-chief, who'd obviously thought through all the likely consequences before launching his attack, knowing evil Iran would capitulate in a matter of hours, is having a few little problems sorting out that blockage in the Straits of Hormuz, which he knows is down to 100% to evil Iran and has absolutely nothing to do with him. Nothing negative, nothing bad ever is. A blockage that may or may not have had something to do with Anthony's vault fast, a cease hostilities. But it certainly shows the extent of the world's fossil behemoths' campaign to transition from themselves. One step back and two steps back. Indeed, quote, energy experts tell us the fossil blockage shows we must develop our vast oil resources and become self-sufficient in pollution, which we thought we already were. Small catch. It, such as in Bass Strait, requires the onomatopoeic fracking. Get fracked, Bass Strait. But a bit of government resolve and conviction and courage could solve that, as one of those experts, Melbourne Uni academic Ian Plunder Fossils, explained. At this point, satire admits defeat. Direct quote. If we had no onerous environmental regulations, which are repeated on the local, state and federal level, if we didn't have any environmental lawfare there, and if we did not have unions stopping construction, it would take us 5 years to become self-sufficient. We can't compete, listener. How can we satirise that? But yet again, it exposes the dangerous threat, an obvious tautology, dangerous threat, these long-haired, commie, greeny, wooden worker denying environmentalists and lazy, avaricious workers are. And again, that scourge of development and productivity and progress, evil environmental lawfare. The polluters have been crying out for environmental lawfare to be outlawed as it retards progress and profit. Without explaining how come in many cases the long-haired, commie, greeny lot win the case, all the more reason to ban them given the law is so grossly, grossly unfair. Oh, and by the way, if you're enjoying breakfast, especially if it's something grown in the soil or that eats something grown in the soil, eat up and enjoy. A Griffith University analysis informed us just 15% of pesticides widely used in true Lavoisier agriculture have full international approval, while 60% of high-use pesticides used in true Lavoisier are banned in the European Union. Interesting that, given our farmers were complaining this week about not enough access to the European Union after we signed that so-called free trade agreement. Anyway, eat up and enjoy. The lowest of the low paid will be able to eat up and enjoy even more than the high life they already live after the Fair Work True Lavoisier No Longer Work Choices Just Looks Like It Con Mission brings down its annual lowest of the low paid wage decision. And let's hope the bench doesn't destroy the economy as we know it, with the ACTU seeking an outrageous 5% increase, which caring employers explain would destroy the economy if we know it, and even the socialists calling for an increase that would be a real increase vis-a-vis inflation. The evil unions making the ludicrous claim that 5% of the lowest of represents 0 point something or other of the national wage bill. ludicrous because, okay, even if the figure is correct, 0.something of the national wage bill is a lot of money. A lot of money being taken from the pockets of caring employers and shareholders. The evil unions are so uncaring. Why, our old mate Innes will cost the workers of the Intrublawassa Industry Profits Group with his revered sensible logic put it succinctly. Above inflation wage demands at a time of weak productivity and a global energy crisis could stoke inflation further and prolong economic pain. And we can but imagine the economic pain poor Innes is suffering. There is a real risk of stagflation, he warned, and then his most sensible and reasonable proposition. All parties must take a responsible and careful approach if we are to navigate these waters successfully. Well, we know the caring employers will take a responsible and sensible approach, but the evil unions always get their timing so wrong, don't they? On evil unions, Lord Rupert of Wapping, through his Wapping sin, was forced to choose between two evils. Evil unions and the evil state socialists, providing two diametrically opposed versions of two strike actions. The teachers' huge strike and march, opposed to the evil state socialists, thus Lord Rupert delivered a favourable report. And the ABC staff off-air for 24 hours, ABC staff air their pay grievances, hit the pub, big headline. Staff hijack the airwaves to put their case for a taxpayer-funded wage rise. And then worse, many headed to the pub. Yes, some were spotted at a hotel, despite holding signs earlier in the day saying they could not afford their power bills. Outrageous. Although maybe it was cheaper to utilise the publican's power. In fact, we all have to tighten our belts, including the government, big economic guru Jim Chalmers Capital agreeing and promising he'll make spending cuts in the budget. The business class pointing out the critical spending we must not cut, like corporate welfare, and the caring business class Hayseed and Sheepshed Parties Coalition joining big business in calling for slashing government spending, while also calling for government support for the caring business class during the fuel crisis, more corporate welfare, without seeing there might just be a slight contradiction in all that. Why, our very own filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina Harthart, displayed her genuine concern for those doing it tough by calling for the tax on fuel to be scrapped, pointing out it would also hurt the caring business class, by coincidence naming the sundry areas in which she happens to have the odd economic interest. It warms the cockles, doesn't it, to know the filthy rich so care about all of us. Although naturally, Gina doesn't want the diesel excise fuel subsidy to her sundry interests cut, understandably. And to show those paid to support the filthy rich are also struggling along, sure, we all noticed reserve losses banks of Primo Michelle Bulldust on the very day she announced another interest rate she understood, compassionately understood, would hurt those doing it tough, settled purchase of a 2 million plus little holiday shack on the New South Wales north coast at Yamba, with lots of delightful, very expensive features, including a glass-enclosed wine cellar. Michelle also has a few other investment properties around Sydney as well as her residence. But she knows her interest rate increases will hurt those not quite able to afford such luxury. It's just the economy of the filthy rich must come first. Couple of finalies. Pollution giant Glenn Rotten to the core, upset at this socialist madness that workers doing the same work should receive the same pay, is asking its directly employed workforce to vote that its labour hire workforce should receive a fraction of their pay, throwing in a few incentives to encourage a yes vote. The evil union claiming it would result in a $36,000 a year wage cut for labour hire workers, let's repeat, doing the same job, while the evil ETEU is threatening strike action in the Pilbara, where the great polluters explain they have lived union-free for decades and union interference in their win-win agreements would cost the poor dears millions. But then, if it's win-win, how come workers joining a union would cost millions? It's a mystery, listener. Good morning.
Trans Day of Audibility returns to 3CR for its fifth year running. 8 hours of wall-to-wall transgender programming, featuring live music, lived experiences, and dispatches from the front line in the war against reaction. Tune in from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 31st of March. 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, 3cr.org.au, 3CR Digital.
You're with Annie and Anila on Solidarity Breakfast. We're coming to the end of the program, but you, of course, as a normal person in normal land, are aware that inflation is considered to be on the rampage, especially related to the US-Israeli war in Iran. On Iran and the oil shortage. We won't even go into the backstory of the Australian government's policies over many governments to reduce Australia's reliance on its own resources. For some reason or other, we don't refine anymore. We just bring things in because that's what capitalists like to do. But anyway, I went off and I had a chat with Alison Pennington, the chief economist for the McCall Institute, about how the inflation cure could be used to improve equality and better governance rather than bolster business interests. You know, the idea of uncoupling the belief that what is good for business is good for us all. This is what she had to say. Thanks very much for talking to me today, Alison. I want to start, you know, at the foothills of this discussion. Can you explain why inflation is considered to be such an economic ill?
Well, inflation is a condition when prices are rising generally across the economy for goods and services. And what that means, if one's income isn't keeping up with the rise in those prices, then your money is buying less stuff. So, you know, people can sustain that in short periods of time, but a rise in inflation that's sustained and one in which wages aren't keeping up has pretty terrible consequences, clearly for workers, in that their purchasing power is eroded. They can't buy the stuff they need, the living standard's lower. We only have to think of the housing market situation to see what it means when your money can't, a salary can't buy, you know, a home in any capital city now.
Yeah.
Financial pressures, they increase on households because the cost of things go up and, you know, mortgage rates go up, so the cost of your debt increases. And then more broadly across the economy, it creates uncertainty for business, which obviously wants to invest in a climate where it knows it's going to make a stable return. And high inflation basically takes away that certainty and can lead to a cutting back of investment and production, which, you know, means throwing people out of jobs and, like, essentially makes the problem worse, because if they're cutting back production, that means we have less supply, less goods and stuff we need. And so you can get into a bit of a vicious spiral.
So why do you think the Reserve Bank, as a norm, decides that to hike interest rates up whenever we look like there's an issue about inflation? Why do they do that?
Well, it's been the inflation management regime of almost 50 years, which kicked off in the late 70s, actually in off the back of the last major oil crisis in the late 70s, when neoliberalism became an ascendant project. And what that project was about was getting government out of the business of directly managing the economy, including prices and wages, and using its taxing and spending powers to basically manage the economy. And this new regime came in where central banks became these key figures, nominally independent of government, though they are public institutions. And they were developed to have this sort of single track focus on keeping inflation at a certain rate. They use interest rates as their lever, and it's their only lever. And what the logic is we make borrowing more or less expensive by setting the cash rate, and that the cash rate is how much it costs for banks to borrow from each other. And the aim is, by lifting or reducing the cost of borrowing money, essentially, you reduce demand. And so if people then have less money to buy stuff, or businesses have less credit to invest in expanding production, then the demand that people are, that's represented by what people are wanting, then aligns with the economy's capacity to actually produce those goods and services. And it's a fantasy, because it follows this current, this like idea of aligning supply and demand, and that there's, you know, some law that does this. But we see very clearly in the case of the Middle East crisis and the war, where in the case of a big supply shock, it's just totally ill fit for reality.
Well, obviously for working people, it's a double hit. They are paying large amounts of money for commodities, essential commodities. They have finding it difficult to deal with their mortgages, and their wages aren't going up.
Yeah, and look, isn't it convenient that when we hit major crises in the economy, capitalism has manufactured a way to make workers worse off? And not just that, it's not just paying for the costs of disruption, but it's also, you know, in the case of, we definitely saw after the 2022 Russia-Ukraine conflict and COVID, and it will be the case now that we have big risk of a wave of sellers inflation, where basically the profit motive of very large, powerful corporations means that they actually exploit this crisis to fatten their pay packets and send workers backwards. And, you know, like you said, this double hit, it's actually already a triple hit, because their wages, real wages, have not kept up with inflation. They're only just really recovering after the last supplier-led inflation wave. So their wages aren't keeping up. So they're already back. They're paying more at the, you know, at the checkouts, and for paying more for petrol. And then the bank comes along and says, actually, you have to give me an extra $450 a month, because the US and Israel decided to bomb Iran and start a new war. And we're going to, you know, there'll be big, powerful companies that profit out of this. And yet we're going to find a way to steal more of your pay packet, under the guise of actually fixing this absolute, you know, crisis that we face.
Well, it's about maintaining their profits, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in this is something that's airbrushed out of the mainstream economic discussion, is that, you know, supply and demand are just these like dispassionate technocratic forces, and that there are like no real major powers or interests in the organization of an economy. But companies don't get into, for-profit companies don't get into the business of producing unless they think they're going to make a profit. And so,
and in fact, they don't actually care what they're producing as long as they get the profit.
Correct, which is one of the big reasons why you need to get government and the public sector involved in delivering the stuff that can't easily be made, you know, for profit. But then going forward, things like dealing with major crises like climate change, it's just, you know, the market is always going to be slow, or, like I said, dispassionate to actually solve big public crises and problems that we face together. And so definitely with this latest conflict, there are, I mean, look at the oil and gas companies. Some are going to be hit by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, but, I mean, Australian oil and gas companies are going to, they're positioned for some serious windfall profits off the back of this war, which is what's leading to increased calls and mobilisation, really, to introduce a windfall profits tax of at least 25% on gas exports, so that, you know, we actually can get the revenue required to take the edge off of some of these cost of living hits on workers.
Let's go back to the profits before we go on to solutions. There's actual data that happened after the COVID crisis, which shows that, these large corporations created what was called sellers' inflation.
Mm. Yes, so this is a new term that's arisen principally, like a lot has been pushed through the work of Isabella Weber. She has put her steely-eyed focus on the organisation and the profit rates of companies out of the COVID pandemic, because obviously what we knew happened then was there was a real, the pandemic itself, the health crisis itself was a big shock to supply chains. And but what happened on top of that technical hit was the relationships of the ownership of production got jacked up, because you know some companies obviously did very well, especially if they were producers of medical goods. But and then after the 2022 Russia-Ukraine conflict, we saw energy companies, gas and oil companies, extremely improve their position, and they're already very high profit rates. They, you know, were able to cash in such a way that created, you know, what many people listening to this will remember was 13 rate hikes we had consecutively in Australia. That was off the back of a massive profit-led inflation wave after the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which was, you know, on our TVs and from our government, what we heard consistently was it was because of Russia's intervention into Ukraine that caused the problem. But actually, there was, you know, that was the original trigger. But it was powerful global multinational corporations who saw a crisis and they decided to make bank from it and cash in on it. And what we need from our government now is a protection against massive profiteering, which we know has happened. It's been, you know, documented and demonstrated in evidenced in research that this is now one of the major risks to making this wartime inflation even worse for workers.
And many times I think people believe, you know, they feel aggrieved by what's going on in their ordinary lives. I mean, and it becomes unsustainable, as you've already pointed out. But there's this background lurking feeling that if this method of dealing with the crisis isn't done, like the increase in interest rates and allowing these profits to happen, that in actual fact the whole system will fall apart. But that's not actually true, is it?
Of course not. I mean, I would say if we continue to hike rates when we know that there are, like, households are incredibly under the pump, because these rate hikes, they don't hit households equally, right? Like they hit about a third of all households with mortgages, who are more likely to be workers, more likely to be, have, you know, to be parents, have, be raising kids. And
well, they wouldn't have taken the risk otherwise, you know, to buy a house.
Yeah, exactly. And more likely to have then very high mortgages. And so people who are in their houses outright, who are more likely to be older and asset rich and wealthier in general, and actually highest consuming, they are untouched. In fact, their position improves. So it's this unequal, it's already, we know that interest rate hikes are only hitting a certain proportion of households. So even on the central bank's own basis for managing inflation, it's technically not sufficient. And then if we wanted to deal with excess demand, you know, so to speak, although what I'm saying is that an oil price crisis is a supply crisis. It's not a, it's a supply inflation problem. It's not a demand problem. But I think in this time, we actually have an opportunity to recast the way that we manage inflation in a way that makes Australia more equal and does share the burden of what is very likely lining up to be a pretty painful hit that, you know, we are only just starting to prepare ourselves for. Like, we know that petrol prices are, you know, $2.20 to $2.50 a litre, and people have been feeling that now for a couple of weeks. But we are on the precipice of something pretty shocking, like pretty significant. I think we're going to see a pretty big increase in inflation. We could be hitting like recessionary territory, unemployment rising. And, you know, Asia has already started rationing its fuel. It's put out work from home directions. decrease speed limits by 10 kilometres. Like, we are maybe moving into the types of wartime inflation control measures which required rationing. And like, we are really, we're not there yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if we started talking about these measures, you know, in the months to come.
And you argue that actually, and this is common, you know, like when there's a, if you're a publicist, you're working out how to make your worst aspects your most positive aspects, this being a downturn that is unavoidable now that this war has been ignited, you argue that Australia must consciously plan for a more resilient, independent and prosperous economy by actually dealing with our dependence on fossil fuel and to use the government levers that will actually help ordinary people, like with childcare costs, you know, that there should be government intervention and it should start governing for all of us rather than just for the business class.
Exactly. As I said at the start of this interview, almost 50 years ago, we started a new regime of inflation management. That's where central banks use their interest rates to slog workers, basically to blame them for inflation. I think we have to go now back to the types of measures we had in place before that regime was introduced, before neoliberalism, where government used its power to directly attack inflation at the source. And there are a number of ways that we can do that. I've put forward a bit of a kind of a multidimensional approach. I think at, in the very least, you've got to look at some pretty high cost items in a household budget and subsidize those immediately. Government did this in the case of the electricity rebates after the 2022 energy price shock. And it had a almost, I think, 0.8 percentage point impact on the total inflation. So I think we can introduce cost of living relief for electricity rebates. Free childcare is a massive cost. With those two, the cost of those two, I think, could be paid for through a windfall profits tax on gas companies, which has been talked about at a 25% rate, raises $17 billion. So it's not small beans. And then, you know, what we had in the 1970s, we had something called a prices tribunal, and legislation was introduced that required where government managed a tribunal, and it investigated, tracked, reported on the prices of that corporations had set for their basics goods and services, and it required large companies to of a certain size, a certain turnover, to come to government and justify why it was increasing its prices. If it was found, if there was found to be profiteering, there would be consequences. And those consequences were never strong enough in the last model we had. But if we had real genuine teeth, I think it could play, you know, it's the kind of protections we need now for Australian workers, but also for our businesses that are going to be depending on inputs from global multinationals. Then I think in the spirit of, you know, sharing the load, well, why don't we deal with the fact that the interest rate manoeuvre that we constantly rely on by central banks does only hit, you know, about a third of all households who are already incredibly under the pump. Why don't we introduce tax reforms that actually deal with high wealth, high consuming individuals who are concentrating their investment activity in places we don't want inflation, like the housing market? So if we actually had the capital gains tax concessions cut, which is being discussed in the upcoming federal budget, that could take investor demand out of new dwellings. And that would have an impact on making, obviously, houses potentially cheaper for first home buyers. Of course, construction costs are about to go up, but it could be maybe a counteracting measure to increase in housing prices. And then wealth taxes, which are something that's been discussed now internationally to deal with the free ride that asset holders get at the expense of workers and wage earners who pay more tax than them. I've proposed through the McKell Institute a model of a wealth tax on ultra-wealthy landholders. It's called the Extreme land wealth levy, and it would levy a tax on people who had land holdings over $20 million in value, and then a higher rate for people over $50 million. And it would include trusts and companies and the kind of the shady ways that very high wealth individuals structure their finances to avoid tax. I think these sorts of wealth taxes, they will then reduce demand, aggregate demand of people who are high consuming, very wealthy individuals. But it then it's also an opportunity to plan for our future that's more egalitarian, less unequal, and one in which, you know, the balance of power really between everyday people and asset holders and then also, you know, powerful corporations is much more in balance.
Mm. Are the government actually governing, I'd have to say?
One might say, yeah.
Yes, one might say. And that's it. That was the wonderful Alison Pennington, who's the chief economist at the McKell Institute. Keep an eye on what she's got to say, because we'll all be railroaded into believing that the best thing to do is to create a system that's best for not undermining the profits of capitalists, but
which is a little interesting rebranding of trickle-down economics, isn't it?
It certainly is. And that's a wrap for Solidarity Breakfast this morning. We're going to go out with The Clash, Johnny Don't Surf.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.